2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies for their entertainment this afternoon and having listened to them. I'm definitely in the camp of cutting a wrap at an angle rather than straight across, lads. It's definitely easier to eat it that way. It's Tuesday the 19th of July and this is Game On. You're listening to Ruby Walsh. Coming up today, Liam Cahill on leaving Waterford Hurlers to return to Tipperary to replace Colm Bonner.
Colm Bonner took on this job at a really difficult time. You know, a lot of injuries, a lot of retirements, and, you know, he was the man that put his hand up, I suppose, last year to take it on, so I can absolutely understand why people would be angry that he wasn't given more time. But
we'll have more from that interview shortly. In athletics, we're live to Oregon for the latest from the World Championships, where Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce has won a fifth gold medal over 100 metres.
I'm just hoping that I'll add to the inspiration, like Alison, to show women that you can have success after 30, after your 30s. You know, you're not limited by anything. And I know especially for shoe companies, they like to think that when women reach a certain age, they want to discard them. But I'm grateful that I'm showing women that it can be done.
In soccer, Mark Langdon and Alan Cawley talk Euros, transfers and a big Champions League night for Shamrock Rovers. And in cycling, Declan Quigley brings us up to speed with the Tour de France as the decisive days in the Pyrenees are underway. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Well, Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce may have been wondering about shoe companies and where her next contract is coming from, but she was going that easy in this morning's 200 metres heat that she had time to fix her wig and still finish second. She had a big turquoise wig on her that got loose after going 50 yards, so she put her hand up, steadied it, and still managed to qualify for the final, which was quite unusual to see in an athletics contest even. But listening to Niall Moran last night, he did tell us that when the final whistle went in the All-Ireland final, all the teams in the hurling championship were back on the starting line, and that is nowhere more evident even than in Waterford and Tipperary. Tipperary, of course, have released Colm Bonner after 1 year of his 3 year term, and Liam Cahill, who had been in charge of Waterford for 3 years, has taken over in Tipperary. It hasn't gone down well in every sector. Some people don't believe that Colm was given enough time at a difficult period in Tipperary hurling, but Liam Cahill is in charge, and earlier Marty Morrissey caught up with him.
Game On
Hurling.
Yeah, I'm absolutely thrilled, Marty. Delighted to be the new Tipperary senior hurling manager. A great honour for me, my family, and my club in Ballingarry here in South Tipperary. So, yeah, a great day for me.
Was it a difficult decision leaving Waterford?
It was, Marty. It's a difficult decision. You know, we had three marvellous years in Waterford. You know, we contested almost all the major finals during that period of time, and obviously winning the league was the highlight of that, but I had done 3 years and I just felt maybe a new voice might be required to get these guys to win the All-Ireland.
I know there were poor performances this year in the championship. Was that the disappointment for you, the poor performances? Was that a factor in your decision?
No, not really, Marty. You know, it's poor performances come at, you know, they come with every team eventually, and you know, to be honest, this year just didn't end the way we wanted it to. I really felt that these players were capable of winning the All-Ireland, and for some reason our year fell flat, and I think, you know, as I said, maybe a new voice might be something that might rekindle the form they've showed with me over the last number of years.
So how did the Tipperary job come about for you?
Yeah, Marty, I received a phone call a short time after the position came available, and you know, it was very simple for me, Marty, when I got the call. It was just, you know, a quick answer, and the answer was always going to be yes this time around. You know, this is our second time of being asked to take on the Tipperary senior hurling manager's job, and you know, the answer was quick for me, to be honest.
There seems to be a lot of anger in Tipperary, Liam, about the way Colm Bonner has been relieved of his duties by the Tipperary County Board. What are your thoughts on that, and your thoughts indeed on the way Colm Bonner was treated?
Yeah, well, Marty, I can relate to that as to why there would be anger out there. Colm Bonner took on this job at a really difficult time. You know, a lot of injuries, a lot of retirements, and you know, he was the man that put his hand up, I suppose, last year to take it on, so I can absolutely understand why people would be angry that he wasn't given more time. But I for one don't know what conversations Colin Bonner had with the Tipperary County Board, and you know, Marty, unfortunately, inter-county hurling is results-driven business, and you know, I suppose results last year during the Munster Championship mightn't have helped Colin's cause, and you know, what can I say? Only that I wish Colin Bonner all the best in the future.
Did the Tipperary County Board contact you before this Colin Bonner was relieved of his duties?
No, Marty, absolutely not. And that's something that I want to be very clear on today, that, you know, I received a phone call a short time after Colin Bonner's exit from the Tipperary senior hurling job. And, you know, for me, second time round, it was very simple. It was a phone call. The answer was yes. And it went from there, Marty, really.
Considering the way Colin Bonner was treated, though, were you hesitant about getting involved as the Tipperary hurling manager?
Yeah, well, look, the Tipperary hurling manager's job is you know, one of the biggest jobs in hurling and in amateur sport in Ireland. It's a big, big job, and it brings its own pressures and responsibilities, and I'm well aware of that. And who's to know, you know, if results don't go my way, Marty, you know, similar conversations will have to be had down the road if that is the case. So I'm well aware of that, but I'm really looking forward to the challenge.
Well, you were a successful manager at under 21 and minor level. You brought Waterford to an All-Ireland final and you won a league title. But there will be huge when the time comes, I suppose, next year, there will be huge excitement and indeed pressure to deliver for Tipperary, Liam. Is that something, A, you're aware of, and B, relishing the challenge?
Yeah, absolutely, Marty, aware of it. You know, when you live in Tipperary, it's the ultimate is you have to be delivering silverware on a consistent basis. And I'm well aware of the challenge that lies ahead. I believe the players are in Tipperary. I believe they are fitting the age profile now that's required to go to the levels needed to be really competitive and ultimately try and win in All-Ireland. And that's my job, and it's the job I'm really looking forward to.
Game on 2FM.
Well, we see how he gets on, whereas it will only be about 30 minutes, 35 minutes even, before we see how Shamrock Rovers get on versus Ludogorets tonight in the Champions League. Second qualifying round, Alan Collier, Mark Langdon. Join me, Alan. It is a big night for Shamrock Rovers tonight. What do they have to do in Bulgaria? Hold out for a nil-all draw, maybe?
Evening, Ruby. Yeah, it is. It's a big night for them. Huge game, obviously, in prospect. And I suppose the financial reward that's on offer, not just for getting through tonight, but maybe the latter stages, if they were to qualify for a group, it's absolutely huge. But they do have a couple of second chances if things don't go as well tonight. And they really are up against it. Ludogorets are a serious outfit. I think in their domestic league, they've won the last 10 leagues in a row. They qualify regularly for the group stages. I think it's four times the knockout stages in the Europa League. They've qualified for the Champions League group stage. They're backed by a billionaire as well, so serious investment in the squad. There's international players dotted all over the team as well, so it's going to be a really tough night for Shamrock Rovers. But as you said, if they can keep themselves in the tie coming back to Tala maybe next week, they really have a chance. And they obviously are our best representatives of a club that has the potential to maybe go to a group stage. So hopefully they can do a job tonight over in Bulgaria, and as I say, keep the tie alive and get themselves back to Tala for what would be an unbelievable night next week.
I like logistics. I'm working out how competitions go, but this European soccer qualifying even has me confused. So if they don't win over two legs, they go down to the Europa League, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Where they have a chance to qualify for that. And if they do win, they're only one stage further on to get into the Champions League.
Yeah, and I think that's ever since the introduction of the Conference League, Ruby, it's designed for obviously the smaller nations with a chance to maybe get to a group stage, because realistically, us challenging for a Champions League group stage is like la la land, really, to be honest with you. As much as you want to believe you can get there, and as much as you have dreams to get there, it is la la land. So I think with the introduction of the Conference Leagues, that certainly makes it very realistic for a club from our country and from our league to maybe get to a group stage, whether that be the Europa League group stage or better still the Conference League group stage, which is even more realistic. And as you say, there is, it's almost like the back door in the GA that we've seen introduced a few years back. It just gives them lower ranked teams that opportunity, that even if they don't qualify for the Champions League, they can drop down to the Europa League. And as I say, the most realistic target would be a group stage of the Conference League.
It looks like the back door to the back door, to be honest with you, when you work it all out. Mark Langdon, will Ludogorets have looked at the draw and thought, oh, Shamrock Rovers, or Shamrock Rovers not so bad?
They probably would file it under the latter there, I think, Ruby, and think that it's not too bad a draw for them, as Alan says, you know, this is a team that's used to qualifying a couple of times for the Champions League, but, you know, definitely been Europa League group stage regulars. That sort of has enabled them to really get a monopoly on the sort of domestic success. And I think that that is a problem in a lot of countries where you get a team that it becomes a real problem because they win the league every year, so then they get into Europe, then they get more money, then they win the league again because they've got more money. And that is a vicious circle, and Ludo Goretzka have managed to get themselves into a good, strong position that way. I mean, if you have a look at kind of the UEFA coefficient rankings, which I always think is a really good guide to sort of the levels of each team. You know, the Irish league is ranked 40 and the Bulgarian league is ranked 24. So Ludo Goretzka are pretty strong favourites, I would say, over the two legs. But it's not an impossible task for Shamrock Rovers, but it's a difficult one.
Alan, you mentioned a while ago they were backed by a billionaire, Ludo Goretzka. Rovers had to fly halfway, split the squad up. Some had to go to Sofia, some had to go through London. Whereas I imagine when Ludo Goretzka are coming back, they'll just be on a charter flight.
Yeah, and it's not an ideal preparation, Ruby, but it's something that obviously has occurred and they just have to get on with it. I think that's what Stephen Bradley said in the press conference last night. Of course, it's not ideal. They did have to split the squad up and all different flights and all different travel arrangements. So that isn't ideal, but as I say, they're over there now and they prepare properly. They're a very professional team, a strong team. Probably something of note, Ruby, as well, and like we obviously followed Lee closely here, but who would have thought the Shamrock Rovers would be going into probably the biggest game of the season against Ludo Goretzka without their three marquee players, which is Jack Byrne, who's not starting tonight. He's been injured over the last 6 to 7 weeks. Graham Burke, something similar. And Danny Mandrow, who scored, I think it was 15 league goals he got for them last year, but he's since moved on 3 or 4 weeks ago as well. So to be going into a game of this magnitude without your three best players as well just goes to show, I suppose, the tough task that's at hand here. But they do have a strong squad. That's not to say they have a weakened team. They still have a very strong team that'll take the pitch tonight, but they are up against it.
They are. Mark, Ludo Goretzka have 9 regular international players. They have a fair budget, like.
Yeah, they do. I mean, the owner has been mentioned a couple of times. Dumyshev, who has made his money in a few different sort of ways, pharmaceutical company being one of them. He decided to get involved into football when Ludo Goretzka weren't even in the top division. So he's really been able to put them on the map. They have got some exciting players dotted around, as you say. One of the things, when they were in the Champions League regularly, they had quite a few Brazilians that used to play for them. There are fewer Brazilians now, but one of them, Carly, in the he's playmaker in midfield. Sotrioyu, the Cypriot striker. Anyone that's watched the Championship might remember the goalkeeper, Sluga, who was at Luton for a little while as well. So, I mean, they have got some good players, particularly in the attacking positions. That's where they've spent most of their money. Not so much this summer, though. More of a settled team this time around. I suppose it's still early in the transfer window, and maybe they're looking to see which competition they're going to be in before they're able to really make their sort of plans for, you know, in terms of who can come in and make an impact for them. But a very wealthy club, yeah, for sure.
So that game is live at 6:45 on RTE2, and it can be streamed live online on the RTE player. Mark, speaking of budgets, explain to me how exactly Barcelona have afforded Robert Lewandowski when they can't afford free.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting one. I mean, we've spoken probably now for best part of, what, a year to 18 months, sort of regularly discussing Barcelona's financial problems, and then they're about to spend sort of more money than any other club this summer. Lewandowski being one of those that's through the door. It won't be the only one either. It is remarkable what they've managed to do, and a lot of people think that this is a huge risk, really, what they are doing. But they've sold their TV rights for the future to a company that's enabled them to get a short-term cash injection. Now, in 10, 15 years' time, they'll probably be paying for that. But it's kind of, I suppose, like going to, a get-quick loan company to get you an injection of cash that long-term is going to cost you a lot of money. But they feel like it's the right thing to do for them. Of course, when you look at it, the president, Laporta, he's probably almost certainly not going to be the president in a decade's time. So it becomes somebody else's problem. And they've done this with a load of their best players. The wages have all been deferred to sort of, you know, years down the line. And whoever picks up the bill for this eventually is going to be, I think, in a real mess with Barcelona. But they're banking on Lewandowski scoring them the goals that can maybe win a Champions League, that can sort of get them back up to the top of European football. He's 34 in August, showing no signs of slowing down, it has to be said. But it's not the way that most sensible clubs would run themselves if they sort of hit financial problems. You know, you'd normally either be looking to bring in young players, develop them, and then sell them on. They're just hoping they can get that kind of stardust back that they had when Messi was there, because Messi brought a lot of people through the door to the Camp Nou, or the Spotify Camp Nou as it is now, because they sold the rights to the stadium as well. So that's another way they've managed to bring in some money into the club. But it's a very risky and not sensible way to do your business. But this is, this can happen when you've got a president that doesn't need to think about the what ifs in a decade's time. He's only interested in trying to win now.
Alan, will you be hoping they manage to get Frankie de Jong's wages sorted out and he comes to Manchester United?
Yeah, I think Frankie de Jong is a player that, he's the calibre of player that Manchester United want to see at their club. And obviously we've spoken long and hard about the last few years, and particularly the recruitment around Man United, and particularly around that midfield area where it's so weak when you compare it to the likes of the Liverpool, Man City, and not even mentioning some of the top European clubs around. And that's obviously the level that they're trying to get back to Man United. I think they're a good bit off that, as we all know at the moment, but certainly signing a player of Frankie de Jong's calibre, I think that would go a long way just to getting people back on side, appeasing people in that regard, and just sending out even a signal or a message just to say, look, these are the type of players that Man United are still capable of signing, because he's obviously very, very good. He would have a relationship with the manager that's gone in now. He's desperate to get him in, and it could be the start of something for the club itself if you were to sign a player of his calibre.
Mark, obviously Lisandro Martinez has also come to Manchester United from Ajax. Small player, Argentinian. Arsenal were interested as well, were they?
Yeah, they were. I think the connection with Erik ten Hag was vital, really, in terms of bringing him to Manchester United. Really interested to see how he gets on. A lot has been made of his height and, you know, whether he can cope with the physical demands of the Premier League, and the fact that, you know, I think it's almost certain that teams will be targeting him from an aerial point of view. You know, they will be aiming crosses over to that left-hand side at him and probably Luke Shaw. He's got a good leap. He's somebody that's really good on the ball, reads the game very well, and if you do that, you could normally get yourself into position where, you know, you can maybe get yourself in front of the forward and make it difficult for them, and, you know, you can be clever about it. I mean, you know, it's not lost on Manchester United that they've signed a kind of small centre-back. You know, they've decided that it's much more important for them, the way they want to play, that he's able to bring the ball out. I think it's really interesting to see what this means for Harry Maguire, because, you know, Maguire is somebody that we've seen on that left-hand side, both for England and Manchester United. He definitely prefers to play on the left-hand side, but Ten Hag in pre-season has been using him more on the right-hand side. So that'll be interesting tactical sort of move there. And you're expecting, given how much Martinez has cost, that, you know, he will be Ten Hag's first choice. And you've got Varane there as well, that we'll expect to play. So it's some big calls ahead, and not least because Maguire was retained as captaincy. I think from, you know, an England national team point of view, Gareth Southgate will have to be watching this very closely. There's a World Cup coming up in just a few months. He won't want to see Maguire sitting on the bench for Manchester United. But I mean, if I was looking at it purely on ability, I would say Varane and Martinez would and should be the first choice for United next season.
That'll be interesting. Bayern didn't delay in spending the money they got for Lewandowski. They've signed the link from Juventus, €80 million, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I think Juventus here will be quite happy to get most of their money back. I think De Ligt is somebody that they expected to grow into a leader, and I'm not sure he's quite done that just yet. There's definitely sort of more to come from him. He was somebody that excelled when he played for Ajax. He went to Italy. I don't think Juventus, the whole team just wasn't playing that well, so it can be a bit of a problem, I think, for anybody individually to shine when the team's not working well. What Nagelsmann, the Bayern Munich manager, wants is a bit like what Ten Hag wants. He wants somebody that can play out from the back. It feels like sort of centre-backs these days, you know, it's, defending is kind of almost secondary, and the most important thing is whether you can bring the ball out of defence and, you know, start off attacks. And De Ligt certainly does that very well. I think he also reads the game, among the best. The problem for De Ligt and for Martinez as well is that they both started out in the Eredivisie, and it's always difficult to know how good they are, because the Eredivisie, when you play for Ajax, it's not far short of being a one-team league, and most weeks you've got the ball and you haven't got to do that much defending. So in terms of Martinez, there's a leap of faith there taken by Manchester United. With De Ligt, he kind of, I think, got better as it went on at Juventus, but I don't think he was a resounding success, because they wouldn't have sold him. You know, they were quite happy to, like I say, to get most of their money back and reinvest in other areas of the squad.
It'll be interesting. Mark, or Alan, sorry, the Women Euros 2022 are down to the quarterfinals. Obviously, tomorrow you have England and Spain, Thursday Germany and Austria, Friday Sweden and Belgium, Saturday France and the Netherlands. I'm sure you've been keeping a close eye on it. Who do you see making it to the final?
Yeah, I've been all over it the last 10 days, Ruby. It's been really good, to be fair, but there's only one standout team, and everybody is going to know who I'm going to say next, and that's been England. And that's not just based on the demolition of Norway, the 8-0 win. They've been the most impressive team in terms of the technical ability as well, what they've showed in the group up to now. Obviously, it's going to get a lot harder because you're down to the cream of the crop with the last 8 left. And there's no weaker sides as such. But I've watched Spain as well, and Spain obviously have lost Patelas before the tournament started, and Jennifer Hermosa as well. They're two star players in terms of goal scoring, and Patelas is the best player in the world, so they lack a real cutting edge. So I see England getting through that. I think Sweden will beat Belgium. Belgium were only okay against Italy last night. Sweden are quite strong, and that'll be a tough game for England because physically they're strong, and Blackstenius up front is very good. Germany and Austria will be a tough battle, but Germany are very, very strong. Strong physically and very well organised, and they've been the second most impressive team for me, Ruby. So I think they'll beat Austria and come through that. France will beat Netherlands, and then you will have England meeting Germany in the final. So that's my prediction.
Good prediction, not so bad. Mark Langdon and Alan Cawley, thank you so much for talking to me this evening. It's time for a quick break. We'll be back with GAA next.
Game on 2FM. Game on
Gaelic football.
Welcome back to Game On, where we're going to turn our attention to next Sunday's All-Ireland Senior Football Final, and we are delighted to be joined by former Galway footballer Gary Sice to look ahead at the weekend. It may be through maroon-tinted glasses, but we're going to look at it. Gary, 21 years Galway have been waiting to be back in Croke Park for an All-Ireland Football Final. Exciting times west of the Shannon?
Yeah, it's good. No, it's good. And, you know, as the week is going on, it's getting more interesting, doing more thinking about it and how it might play out and how we need certain things to go this way and that way, to hope when this happens, that happens. So it's good, yeah. It's good to be there again for the boys too. They've done well this year.
They have done well, and that's what's going to be. It's going to be a huge tactical battle. But I was reading a few comments you made in the press during the week, and you described this Galway team as a hybrid, probably, between what Kevin Walsh started and what Pádraig Joyce has finished. What exactly do you mean by that?
I suppose when I was involved maybe 5 years ago, we were probably what people thought was ultra defensive in times, and we got back behind the ball, etc. Dublin and Kerry were doing it too, it's just they weren't talking about it. But we now see that Ballygowie are leaving a few more players further up the field, and it's somewhere in between what we were doing with Kevin and what Pádraig Kelly envisaged when he came in first of ultra attacking football. So I think it's a pragmatic approach to the players they have available at the minute, and they seem to have found a structure that allows the players are there to express themselves and play at a good level.
It's definitely working. I mean, wins over Armagh and over Derry, where at times you seem to out-Derry. Like, that mix is there, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit of experience too, and it's a small bit of understanding of a system better than they had. Some of the lads now are there a while, and it was kind of, it's time for them to start producing. I think it was a patience game against Derry. Having played in the league was a big help as well. They went up to Owenbeg and played out there, and on the day gave them a bit of a trimming, actually. I think that would have given them a fair bit of confidence in the championship then. But they definitely have shown great discipline in what they're doing all year, and to be fair, they've improved game on game in what they're doing.
When you're looking at the weekend, Galway are the underdogs, Kerry are the favourites. You said you've been thinking about what way it's going to go and what has to go right for you. As you look at the opposition from a Galway perspective, where do you see the weaknesses in Kerry? Or are there any?
You're playing Kerry at the end of the day in Ireland in the final. So as far as matchups go, it's a great place to be because you know you're going to get into a football match. But I think the game has evolved a good bit since the last time Galway and Kerry were in Ireland in the final together. I think now you're looking at, first of all, how can you get your own thing in order so you can go and hurt them? But you also have to be very mindful that they have got one of the best forward lines in the country at the minute. So you've got to be very, very careful with them. So I think Galway will look at stopping one or two key patterns of play that Kerry have developed, and hopefully that they'll shut down some of the channels into their dangerous forwards. And the other side of this too, I don't know how many games Kerry have been pushed in this year. I don't know that they have actually gone. I know the last day with Dublin, it was tough at the end of it, but I think they could have been a lot out of sight at half time had they pushed on. I think there was a psychological battle going on in their own heads over trying to beat Dublin more so than anything else, but it'll be interesting to see if they can be put under pressure again, how they react to it.
Obviously they've moved Tadhg Morley into a more sweeper position, sitting there in front of the D. How are Galway going to go about exploiting that? What do you do to open Kerry up, to give yourself the scoring chances? Because you can't win if you don't score either.
No, and I suppose this is one of the interesting things about Kerry this year. They have developed this new system, and there's a lot of talk about Paddy Talley's influence in the group and how they've got Tadhg Morley freed up. But I don't know that the system has been tested massively yet. I think had Conor Callaghan played the last day for Dublin against Kerry, that system would be tested more. I'm not so sure that it's been absolutely pushed to the limit yet. And I think we might just have the tools available to them. Damien Comer, Shane, Rob Finnerty, these guys might just be able to push that system a little bit harder than it has been before. And I think there are opportunities there. Sometimes when you make a change like they have done in Kerry with Tadhg Morley dropping in like that, it doesn't just happen in one season. It might take a little bit more than that, and it might take a bit more scrutiny in bigger games for them to find out where the holes are. And I'm hoping that Galway will be able to find some new holes that they haven't discovered so far in the championship in the Kerry defence.
Obviously, with the game Damien Comer had in the semi-final, could you see Kerry man-marking him, keeping him quiet, and then does that pressure fall on the likes of Rob Finnerty, Johnny Heaney, Shane Walsh?
I think it was interesting in the Derry game, some of the matchups that Derry went with. It wouldn't have been the ones we would have thought. Christy McKay picked up Rob Finnerty, and to be fair, did a massive job. I think Rob might find himself a little bit freer. The next day he might be able to get on a bit more ball. He's a very dangerous operator for us when he's going. He played very well against Armagh. Great finisher. I think Damien is going in and out. He's not staying in the full forward line that often, so it'll be interesting to see who they detail him when he comes out the field. Great man to go for a kick out and break on ball as well. So I think the movement around the place with the Galway forwards might be also a test for the system that Kerry had developed. Who sits back in the centre back when Tadhg Morley goes will also be a big factor. And if Gavin Whitehall injured now as well, it's a change in personnel, which can change the habits back there. So there are a few questions that are unanswered about them as of yet. As I said, I hope to God we can pose some questions for them too when the time comes.
That's one end of the pitch. You go to the other end of the pitch then, you look at the two Cliffords, Shawnee O'Shea. How exactly are Galway going to keep them under wraps?
Yeah, that's a whole different thing, isn't it?
Oh, stop.
I don't know, from
a non-footballing background, I mean, no matter how far out you push them, they seem to be able to kick points from everywhere.
Yeah, well, we're talking about a generation of talent in David Clifford. We're talking about something we probably haven't even seen before, to be quite honest with you. Like, you see them play Ireland semi-final last year, he got 8 points, and we were saying the man marking him had quite a good game. That's the standards we're dealing with this man. He got 6 the last day, and people were giving out to kick 3 or 4 wides. So we're dealing with something different here. I think if we can keep him below average, if we can keep him to 3 or 4 points, then we're going to leave ourselves in a really good position. I mentioned at the start, the patterns of play that they develop in order to get ball into him are something to be looked at for Galway. If they can block up a few channels and maybe limit the ball he gets, or even make it bad ball into him and make it for 2-on-1s inside, that might help us. But it's awful idle talk because it's much easier said than done. We're dealing with a serious football team that have, there's a capable of launching into serious passes too. So it's going to be a key part of the game, but I'm not so sure if there's one answer to that question. There's probably multiple facets to it that we're going to have to try and sort out as the game goes on.
No doubt. We saw over last weekend, I know in different disciplines, the benefit of a fast start. We saw it for the rugby team in New Zealand. We saw it for Limerick and Croke Park. Would you think Galway have to get out of the traps quickly, get on the front foot, get Kerry chasing them to have any chance?
Yeah, it'd be lovely to turn the screw in them early. It'd be lovely to get 2 or 3 scores on the board early, settle into it, get that Galway crowd into it, and even to get the Galway structure set up so that they can frustrate Kerry earlier on. you don't want him getting a goal early, you don't want David Clifford clipping a few points early and getting him settled into the game. So I think to start, it's huge. I think both teams are going to be jittery. It's hard to say who there's more pressure on. Galway haven't gained a while, obviously, but everyone is telling us that the All-Ireland final was on last weekend with Kerry and Dublin. So is there an internal pressure in Kerry? You'd like to think there is, and hopefully Galway can get a quick start and double up on that pressure.
You spoke about getting the crowd behind you. There was a full house there for the hurling last weekend. How big a crowd do you see coming from Galway? Do you think they'll fill Croke Park again? Will there be a sea of maroon?
Yeah, I'm looking out the window here now and it's was flags up and down the road. It's nice to see, and I think there's a hashtag Turn Galway Maroon going on at the moment as well. It's evident around the place. There's a good old reaction to it, and my phone has happened for tickets the last 2 days as well. So obviously people looking to go, and I think Galway will travel big. We have a decent record in Ireland finals up there as well when we do get to them, so I think people will be excited to be there. And as I said, playing against Kerry is going to lead to some good football, and we're going to see some nice stuff, I think.
We touched off the matchups on the pitch. What about the matchup on the sideline? Jack O'Connor, been there, done that. Pádraic Joyce, not new to it, but a new ball game for him. How do you see them shaping up, or who do you see Jack's experience as an advantage, or is Pádraic's not in?
I think Jack is an interesting character. I don't think he went back in there for the crack of it. I think he saw an opportunity in the group that was there, and to be fair to him, his record speaks for itself. One of the top inter-county managers. I think Pádraic has made a very shrewd addition to his management team in Keane O'Neill, and Keane has been around All-Ireland winners the last couple of years. He's been in Tipperary, he's been in Kerry, he's been in Mayo, and seen both sides of it there as well. But as I said, he's been at the high end of it, and I think he's going to be a key part of getting this group ready for a big day like this in Croke Park. And I think his experience of the organisation side of it, and that is going to be key. And of course Pádraic has gone and done it, so I think it's a nice mix for us to have as well. But probably the two guys in the sideline will have to get as much organisation done they can before Wednesday this week, and after that then it's down to the lads to go out in the field.
Well, no, nobody likes to look too far ahead and doesn't really want to talk about winning, but could you have ever envisaged Galway bringing Sam Maguire back to Ayr Square on the opening evening of Race Week? It could be the greatest party of all time.
If I'm totally honest with you, I think no one in Galway looked past the Mayo game this year. I think the way it settled up in the Championship, we could see a pattern developing and kind of had an idea who you might be playing. But I think going to Castlebar at the start of the year was the one. And once we got over that, it was kind of game on game from there. And even from the supporters' point of view, you were always going, geez, you could take these. But there was never any talk about them bigger than that. I think that was a nice way to do it, and I think it's a nice way for good players to go through a championship. They're going game to game. To be fair, since the first round of the league, we've been talking about Kerry winning the All-Ireland, so that brings a different type of pressure on them, and it's been a nicer way for Galway to go through a championship, I think, than the way Kerry have had to do it.
Well, they've earned their way to the final. Gary, I am completely neutral. I won't be shouting for anybody, but I will say I will join in the party in Ayr Square after Monday evening of race, on Monday evening of race week, should Galway win. Thanks a million for taking our call. That was Gary Sykes, who's teamed up with AIB to look ahead to Sunday's final. For more behind-the-scenes action from the Football Championship, follow AIB GAA on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram.
Game on 2FM.
So the Tour de France is in its final week and is coming to a fair crescendo as the riders made their way into the Pyrenees this afternoon for stage 16, which went from Carcassonne all the way to Foe. But before we get to the general classifications, there was an emotional victory today for Hugo Hue, who the Canadian rider who won his first ever road race. But that only tells half the story. I am delighted to be joined by Declan Quigley. Declan, there were emotional scenes as he crossed the line this evening.
Ah, yeah, it was really heartwarming stuff, I have to say, Ruby. Hugo Hue, a French-Canadian, 31 years of age, took his first road race win, a couple of time trial victories, all he ever had before that. And he rode an absolute stormer. It was one for the water carriers today. He got into the early break, big break, not a threat on GC, and it was quite the bun fight. But he beat some really strong riders to do it. And when he came across the line, he was pointing at the sky. And of course, he and everyone else realised and knew exactly what this was about. His brother was a mad bike racing fan, as he was, and 10 years ago he was killed by a hit and run, or a drink driver, but while he was out running. And so it was kind of poignant, emotional, and it was very much dedicated to his brother Pierrick.
And to see that emotion in him when he was interviewed after the race, like, it kind of wasn't your usual cyclist interview. It was just raw emotion.
He's 12 years of pro this year. I mean, he dedicates himself to others all year, gets rare opportunities to race for his own interests. Remarkably enough, Canada hadn't won a stage of the Tour de France since 1988, and they had two riders in the breakaway. Michael Woods was there as well, and if anyone was going to win a stage of the Tour for Canada, it was going to be Michael Woods over the last few years. But lo and behold, it's Hugo Ull that came up with it, and Woods finished third on the day for the Israel Premier Tech squad. So, yeah, I mean, it's raw emotion, you know, the memory of his brother Pierrick, but also it's such a rare thing and a massive, massive thing for any rider in his career. It's career-defining stuff.
The tactics of cycle races always fascinate me, and Hugo said in his interview when he went on the last climb, it was to lead Mike Woods, but Mike didn't get on his wheel, let him go, then decided to shout into his own radio to Hugo that Hugo was gone, and away Hugo went, and it was almost like Mike Woods just held the rest behind him.
It's a team sport. It's fundamentally a team sport. Okay, you've got to be one of the best athletes out there, and generally speaking, when it comes to the big mountains, if you've got a bigger set of lungs and better power to weight ratio, you're probably going to prevail. But then, as we've seen already in the general classification fight, there are, you know, the team tactics come into in a huge way, and the best rider can often be beaten by a team that's better organized, that has greater resources, greater strength and depth. And I mean, that would have been a good demonstration of it in the breakaway today. Israel Premier Tech, they send Ull out there early. That means that Matteo Jorgensen, the American rider, has to do the chasing. Woods sits in the wheels, sitting pretty, waiting when the catch is made. But the catch was never made because Ull was able to, you know, was that much stronger than Matteo Jorgensen. So he was the one who got the win. It's a team sport.
And the teams are going to be vital for the next couple of days. The next tomorrow stage, stage 17 in the Pyrenees, is only 129.7 kilometres, only, I say. Three Category 1 climbs, one Category 2 climb, three and a half hours of cycling. But how the teams fare is going to be crucial to the general classification. Obviously, Jonas Vingegaard is in front. Pogacar is in second, 2 minutes 22 seconds behind him. It's going to be a game of cat and mouse all the way up the Pyrenees.
It's been the most remarkable Tour de France. I haven't seen racing like this since the 1980s. It's just, they're knocking spots off each other. It's they're punching each other to a standstill at this stage. And remarkably, today, Pogacar, who won the last two editions of the Tour de France and has looked like the imperious king of cycling and likely to be that for another 5-6 years from now, he had this one day without, this extraordinary stage 11, you know, when he gave up his lead, finished seventh on the day, lost 2:51, I think, to Jonas Vingegaard. Now finds himself, 2:22 down with 5 days to go. And Vingegaard looks absolutely teak tough. He finished second in the Tour de France last year. Mind you, he was over 5 minutes down in Pogacar. It was like Pogacar and the rest. But Vingegaard this year, much stronger. And the Jumbo-Visma squad, talking about those team tactics, I mean, on that stage 11 to Col du Granon, Pogacar looked great all day and was sort of cock of the walk over the first two big climbs. But then up the Col du Granon, the last one, he weakened. And Vingegaard had the team all day that were constantly putting Pogacar under pressure. And finally, he cracked. And that's been the difference between them. But since then, Pogacar is the one chasing the race. He's been attacking left, right and centre. You can't miss a minute of it because they're literally attacking from the gun all day. It's crazy racing. It doesn't make any sense, but it's really super to watch. And as you say, we've got five more stages, three of which are big GC appointments. They're big. There's a big potential for a change on general classification. And as you say, today was the first of three mountain stages in the Pyrenees. It was a bit of an hors d'oeuvre, really. It was a really, really tough day out. But as you say, tomorrow to Peyre Ragout. And as you mentioned, it's only 130 kilometres, and counterintuitively, they can be tougher because it means you're in the mountains all day. There's no recovery. There's a certain amount of recovery in the valley and on the descents, but in reality, it's just you spend a greater percentage of the day climbing those big mountains, and it's a potential banana skin for Vingegaard. It's another opportunity for Pogacar, but his tactics have been, I mean, he simply can't attack left, right and centre. He has to pick his moment. But as we say, it's a team sport and both teams are slightly reduced. Both Vingegaard and Pogacar have lost a couple of key lieutenants in the last few days. So it's sort of thinning out the team aspect and making it more of a one-on-one Ali versus Fraser kind of fight.
As you watched it today, every time Pogacar attacked, Vingegaard was on his wheel. Pogacar obviously has to attack when he hasn't got Vingegaard on his wheel. How does he get him off his wheel?
There's almost nothing between them, and you know, that's the headache for Pogacar, because when you're attacking, you're the one that's sort of cutting into the wind. Vingegaard just has to say absolutely welded to his wheel. Now that's incredibly stressful, but still it's an obvious tactic. He doesn't have to think too hard about what he has to do. He just has one thing, and that's to follow Pogacar. Don't let him get 10 bike lengths ahead of him. And oddly enough, on the climbs, Vingegaard has looked absolutely solid, but there could be an opportunity for Pogacar maybe to attack on a descent, or maybe in the valley. The teammates will come into it. They'll put them up the road in the early move. They'll be available to their team leader when they're caught later on in the stage. We saw a little bit of that today. We'll see more of it tomorrow. But we're coming to two summit finishes in a row. Peyregourde tomorrow, and then we go up the Hautacam, which is a real beast of a climb, on Thursday, after which we have a sprint stage on Friday, and then the time trial on Saturday, which is another opportunity. And you know, 2 years ago, Pogacar shocked everyone by winning his first tour, overhauling Primoz Roglic, who's Jonas Vingegaard's Jumbo-Visma teammate. He pinched that one on the second last day, and I think Vingegaard is at least as good a tester, if not better, than Primoz Roglic, so he won't be too concerned about it. But the knowledge of what happened a couple of years ago, and the fact that we've got still a couple of big mountain opportunities, it's going to make it a really interesting final week.
It looks between the two of them to win the Tour de France, but Geraint Thomas is hanging on to that third podium place. Will he be there in the Champs-Élysées on Sunday? Can he hang on to the podium?
He can certainly hang on to the podium. His performance is so intelligent, so bright. He's 36, so I mean, he's up against Pogacar, who's a young tyro at 23, Vingegaard just 25. I mean, it's not that long ago since the received wisdom in bike racing was that you wouldn't necessarily start someone that you thought could win the Tour de France until they were 24 or 25. At this stage, Pogacar's 23 and he's won it twice already. By contrast, Geraint Thomas is coming into the twilight of his career, so today it was noticeable on at least a couple of occasions that he would be distanced by attacks from Pogacar, and with Vingegaard following, and instead of panicking, he would just continue to ride his own pace, just ratchet it up a tiny fraction. He had Adam Yates there to assist, Danny Martinez a little bit late on, and they just played a very intelligent game. But it was a rearguard action from Thomas, so it does require something spectacular to happen to Vingegaard and for him to stay with Pogacar in order for him to really imagine that he's going to win the race. Having said that, with his time trialing ability in particular on Saturday, I think Geraint Thomas is, I won't say odds on for the podium, but I think it's surely on, yeah.
Well, as you said, Declan, it has been riveting viewing. I must say I enjoyed it this afternoon. I will be glued to it tomorrow to see what happens between Pogacar and Vingegaard. Thanks a million for coming in to talk to us. We have another quick break to take. We'll be back.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So the World Athletics Championships are underway in Oregon in the United States. They started on the 15th of July and run all the way to the 24th. It's a 10-day athletic competition and we are on day 5. Cathal Dennehy joins me live from Oregon. Cathal, is it fair to say it has been a mixed, possibly average championships thus far for Irish athletes?
Yeah, I think it's been the usual, probably mixed bag. I mean, we had some rays of light, I suppose, in the likes of the heat performance by Andrew Cosgrove, over 1500, brilliant performance to get through to the semi-final, and Thomas Barr, really impressive after recent injury problems, marching into the semi-final. But both of them, I'd say the only word you could use is absolutely disgusted with the way they performed in the semi-final. Thomas Barr, something went a little bit wrong with his stride pattern, a little bit of headwind on the back straight just messed him up a little as he was coming around the turn and stumbled off the 8th hurdle, and that really was put paid to his chances. And what was galling really for Thomas Barr was it was probably the best chance he will have or has had at making a world final. The time he ran in his heat, he just needs a fraction faster than that and he was into the world final, and he's never made a world championship final, but he has obviously finished fourth in the Olympics, so it's an achievement that has again eluded Thomas Barr, and he was just utterly sickened after that. And as for Andrew Koskin, yeah, he was very disappointed. You know, he ran a brilliant heat, but 24 hours later maybe just didn't quite get the recovery right to be able to put it back to back and come back the next day. So he was quite upset, I suppose, with his performance as well in the semi-final. And elsewhere, yeah, it's been, you know, Eric Favors did reasonably in the shot put. John Kelly from Finn Valley was just miles off his best, two fouls in his shot put round and then just a 17-metre throw. And then Sarah Healy probably once again, perhaps the occasion just I suppose, perhaps getting to her really in terms of she wasn't able to reproduce here what she did in recent weeks. She ran 4.02 for 1500 on the circuit. You know, she was miles off that here, so very disappointing for her. But I think for a lot of these athletes, at least they have the European Championships around the corner. That's less than 4 weeks away now, so rather than the usual kind of despondent way you might go away from a championship after disappointment, you know, at least they have something now to get back in, put in a good 3 week training block, and I suppose finish their seasons on a high.
All is not lost yet. I mean, Chris O'Donnell is still going, so is Radisha Adeleke. How, what can they expect to achieve? They both have qualified for the next round.
Yeah, I suppose I should just mention off the back of that there, you know, the mixed relay, who I didn't mention there, was obviously the huge ray of light at the moment, having made that world final. And there's no doubt about it, you know, Jack Raftery was magnificent, recording a 45-second split, the young Denor Harrier there. But, I mean, the star of that team was Rashida Adeleke, a 49.8-second split she ran. She's only 19, and I can't stress enough how absolutely magnificent that time is. And to have run around with a baton in her hand and dodging all the traffic, she had to run a time like that. Now, she felt unwell that afternoon, so she pulled out of the final, and as a result, the mixed relay team were, you know, eighth and last place in the final, and they were never going to compete without Rashida in there. But Rashida came back 2 days later on Sunday and marched into the semi-final in second place, and she had a lot in reserve. And she said afterwards she didn't go out. Her semi-final is tomorrow night. It's at 2:45 a.m. Irish time, so in the early hours of Thursday morning. And she has the two-time Olympic champion, possibly the greatest 400-metre female athlete of all time, Shauna Miller-Weibo, is in the main outsider, who has just magnificent 200-metre speed as well. So she's going to go out like a rocket. And Rashida, I think, is going to have no choice but to go with her. She's run 50.70 this year, but that was in her second ever race, just a day after her first ever outdoor 400 metres earlier this year. So you can add maybe half a second to the relay split, but Rashida is definitely capable of running low 50 seconds here tomorrow night. And I think if Rashida can do that, she stands an outstanding chance of getting into a world final, which at the age of 19 for an Irish sprinter would just be remarkable. And then obviously Chris O'Donnell is also into that world semi-final. It's going to be much, much harder for him. You know, he's run 45.26 this year. He would have to probably smash 45 seconds to get into a world final. He's very unlikely to do that, especially with two rounds of the mixed relay and his heat in the legs. But, you know, if he can break that personal best and get a little bit closer, take another chunk off toward David Gillick's Irish record of 44.77, it'd be a remarkable championship for the Sligo man.
It most certainly would. There's been some remarkable performances there. The Jamaican ladies dominated the 100 metres. Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce, she's showing age is only a number, isn't she?
She really is, you know. I mean, she's just defying kind of convention, really. And I think there's probably no doubt that technology is helping in this regard, because having talked to some athletes out here and some coaches, you know, they do say that the technology that's currently in super spikes is causing athletes to run a little bit differently, protect the lower limbs and make them more efficient. And one coach I talked to said it's worth up to about a tenth of a second over 100 metres. So yeah, she won her seventh global 100 metre title the other night, which is just astonishing. And the fastest of them all came at the age of 35. So yeah, she really is, I suppose, defying conventional wisdom. And I suppose you just have to take your hat off to her leading that Jamaican clean sweep.
Tonight's big race is the men's 1500 metres final, reading Steve Cram earlier in the week. It looked like it's a massive race.
Yeah, 1500 metres will be the main draw, I suppose, tonight, along with the men's 400-metre hurdles, which is probably the race of the Olympics, I would say, in any sport come Tokyo. The men's 1500-metre final tonight goes to the line. Irish time is on at 3:30 a.m. 400-metre hurdles is on at 3:50 a.m. For any insomniacs or athletic anoreks back home, that'll be well worth getting up and watching on BBC, because the men's 1500, Jakob Ingebrigtsen of Norway is the current king, 21 years old, basically swept all before him in the last 2 years. But he has some big contenders here. And as you mentioned, Steve Cram, it looks like we could have the next great British miler in Josh Kerr, who was the Olympic bronze medalist. He's always a confident guy, the Scot, but he's speaking in extra brash, kind of cocky terms in the last couple of days. And he's wearing these oversized, ridiculous-looking gold sunglasses. And as you said, you know, if you're wearing gold sunglasses like that, there's a good reason for it, and that you're highly, highly confident about the form. Now, he was celebrating early as he kind of ran down in the heat ahead of Jakob Ingebrigtsen, and Ingebrigtsen was asked about Kerr's celebration after semi-final, and he said, look, it's easy to celebrate when you're running slow. So Ingebrigtsen is still the king, but Kerr is very much coming for him. He's a Scottish athlete, but he's based up the road in Seattle, and he said he's using the time difference to his advantage, I suppose. Wales as a, being based on the west coast of the US, and it's going to be a heck of a clash between them. And you also have Kenya's Timothy Cheruiyot, the reigning world champion, and Abel Kipsang. They'll be in the scrap for the medals as well, so really looking forward to that one later. And in the 400 metre hurdles features Carsten Warholm, the world record holder, the Olympic champion, but who tore his hamstring back in May in Rabat in Morocco and missed several weeks of training. He looked great in his heat in semi-final, but we just won't know. And he has two very worthy challengers in Brazil's Alisson dos Santos, who's the fastest in the world this year, Olympic bronze medalist, and Roy Benjamin, who very cruelly absolutely smashed the world record behind Warholm in Tokyo last year. He's had injury issues as well. He had a bad bout of COVID and he had a hamstring niggle for the last few weeks, so he might not quite be working to 100% either, but it's just going to be fascinating because I think Dos Santos, Warholm and Benjamin are all going to be coming to that 10th hurdle pretty much together. And then it's, I suppose, who keeps his head best when all around they're losing theirs down the home stretch.
Carl, you almost have me convinced to get up at 3:30 in the morning. Thanks a million for taking our call. I hope you enjoy it. That's all we have time for. Ronan Lawler was your producer. Betta Da was on sound. Damien O'Mara is with you tomorrow. My apologies to the news for getting there late. I hope everyone else has a good evening. Thank you.